I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me, and I'll try to give. well, I was thinking you. So I'll talk kind of more on the side of understanding the fundamental limits of using spins to make measurements. How we can do better, and only at the end, talk a little bit about the actual precision measurements that we are working on right now or recently finished. So first, if you just ask a basic question, suppose I have a spin, what can you do with it? And the first thing that comes to mind is that, okay, most particles, all particles spin have a magnetic moment, so you can measure magnetic fields, so you can build good magnetometers. Then if you think a little harder, you can also remember that the spin can be a gyroscope, and so that means that you can do inertial rotation sensing using spins as well. So that's all that you can really do within the standard model. And so then once you go beyond the standard model, then you can write more and more terms, and historically people have thought of more terms. So first people thought about EDM experiments by Purcell and Ramsey in the 1950s, and this has been a big field continuing since then. Then a little bit later, people have thought about rotational invariance and Lorentz symmetry. And so these are known as Hughes-Drewe experiments. And more recently, Al Kostalecki has developed a more complete theory of Lorentz violation, CPT violation, which coupled to spin is a vector field or a tensor field, or even some more complicated combinations of vectors, which represent some kind of background field, which is presumably constant, or assumed to be constant. Now, if you have other kind of light particles, they will introduce forces between spins. And so axion is sort of the most famous of it. It was first known by Wilczek in 1984. And again, it sort of started a whole field of measurements, trying to constrain them under various conditions. Then if you think about dark matter interacting with it, you can think about that it produces an EDM that will oscillate at the axion frequency. So this term was first written down by Kim and Sakivis, so I don't know, in 1990. And then you can also generate an axion wind, which will give you kind of an oscillating magnetic field. And then more recently, this sort of became more interesting because of the more sort of practical experimental ways of detecting these effects basically by Peter and Sargita that have been proposed, and Dima has been working on it. Now if you go back to kind of the basic question of how you measure spin precession, the frequency of it is precession is just proportional to the magnetic field with some fundamental constant in front of it. And so if you do very well in making this measurement, you might be limited just by quantum noise at the very end. And that's due to the fact that you have n discrete spins. And so even if you align them all in the same direction, the transverse components will be random. And so you'll have an uncertainty in the phase that will go as 1 over square root of 1, at least if you don't do anything too fancy with spin squeezing and so on. So then you can also think about it as a kind of a resonance line that you're trying to find the center of it with certain precision. So one can simply write that for a single measurement, the uncertainty in the frequency is this phase uncertainty divided by how long you can make a measurement on the order of the spin coherence time. And then if you repeat this measurement many times over some measurement time t, which is much longer than t2, and then you get sort of a standard expression like this, which tells you what is uncertainty in frequency measurement after a long time. So then the question is, if you have these atoms, whatever the atoms are, in a box, what will limit the coherence time? So in the simplest picture, we assume that the walls of the box don't do anything, and so the atoms just collide with each other, and that's what's limiting the spin coherence time. So you can generically write an expression like this. We have some cross-section, some velocity, and some density of atoms. And then you can see that this uncertainty in the frequency will become actually independent of the density, and it will depend more on the volume of the box in which you contain the atoms. Or you can write the magnetic field, which is simply related by this equation here, where gamma is a general magnetic ratio. And so again, it's independent of the size of the box. Now, it turns out it's convenient to think about this uncertainty in terms of an energy uncertainty. So you imagine you have this box and you have some uncertainty in the magnetic field. So you ask the question, what is the uncertainty in the energy contained in the box, just from the uncertainty of the B, assuming the average B is zero. And so you get this expression here. And now even the volume of the box will drop out. And you have just something that depends on the properties of the atom, like the collision cross-section and the magnetic moment. And then the units of it, then, you know, magnetic field, you measure the noise per unit bandwidth, so it's per square root of hertz, and the energy resolution has units of joule second, which, of course, is units of h bar. So it turns out that this one can be compared with h bar. Now, if we go to a squid, where some of this maybe people have seen in the past, if you ask what is the energy resolution of a squid, again, you have a loop, and there is some magnetic field penetrating, so you can write the energy resolution as the uncertainty in the flux square over the inductance of the loop, and then the inductance grows as the size of the loop. So again, you end up with energy resolution, which goes as a cube of the linear dimension of that coil. And of course, not surprising it will have the same relationship, since it should have the same units. Now, a squid is not exactly just this. It usually has some resistors across it to make it a linear device. Otherwise, it will be hysteretic. And so it's been shown generally then that once you have these resistors and you have zero-point fluctuations that we discussed yesterday, then you will have some limited limited minimum amount of energy resolution you can have. And if you optimize everything, then that energy resolution is just h bar over 2. And that sort of is related to the fact that you can think of it as a linear amplifier. So this is sort of a well-known result that a squid would have energy resolution of h bar over 2. So the question now is, what happens with spins? Now, the first simplest thing you can imagine is to think about spins in the rigid lattice and just naively say, okay, they're all sitting there, and then they create a dipolar magnetic field around each spin, which is this order. Then you ask the question, how long it would take for the neighboring spin to precess by some significant angle in that dipolar field. And that's given by this. And if you just take that as a relaxation rate and then plug in everything else into these expressions, you end up with surprisingly the same factor, h bar over 2. And so you sort of say, oh, well, maybe the collection of spins like that would have the same resolution as a squid. So maybe perhaps there's something fundamental about this. But this has turned out to be a somewhat simplified picture, because the spins don't have to sit rigidly on the lattice. They can move around. And so if you look in a liquid or in a gas, typically the coherence time you actually see is much, much longer than what you would naively estimate for a rigid material, or what you actually see experimentally in a solid. So in a liquid and a gas, T2 is longer because the atoms are tumbling around, and so they don't have enough time to precess in this dipolar field, and the dipolar field averages out over a time scale of the correlation time. So then you end up basically with an expression of this order. So the faster you're moving, you'll have a longer of the coherence time. So then the question is, what's sort of the best you can do? And helium-3 is a good example of a system where you can actually calculate things and measure things. And it's a well-isolated magnetic moment with weak interactions between atoms. And so it's been measured where this lifetime is in days, and this pressure is in atmospheres, or amagats, the same as atmospheres. So basically, if you have one atmosphere, you have this lifetime. So it's very, very long. And now, this is a measurement of T1, but you expect T2 to be equal to T1, because these are binary collisions and they're very fast. And you can actually calculate, if you assume the interactions between the atoms are very weak, you could get analytical expression for what is the value of T1 as a function of the magnetic moment of the spin, just because of the of the motion with a finite temperature. What you will find, not surprisingly, is the relaxation time goes as the force power of the magnetic moment. And then it means that if you plug it back into those equations, the uncertainty in the magnetic field is actually proportional to the magnetic moment, which means that if you have a smaller magnetic moment, you will actually have better sensitivity to magnetic field because you win faster in the coherence time than you lose in the fundamental sensitivity here of the magnetic moment.
What is the mass
of mass Q? This is mass. No, this is the mass. This is the mass of the particle.
Of the particle. How do I see that it should be mass cubed? Is there?
Well, so there's KT, and so then there is.
On the other side.
So it's basically how fast they pass each other.
Assume
that you have a gas and they just passing each other.
Yes.
So that's right. And you assume there's not any strong interaction. So this is only valid in the limit of high temperature. So they don't actually come too close to each other. But all of it is worked out in this paper by Will Harper. What you can do then is you can look at different species and see what you'll find. And many of these things have actually been measured, like helium-3 already said is measured, at least T1, I assume T2 is the same. So what you find then is that suppose you have a volume of 1 cm³, so then you can ask the question, what is the frequency resolution if you just measure the frequency of the spin, which is kind of what you care about if you look for some kind of new effect, or you can ask a question, what is a magnetic field resolution, or this energy resolution that is sort of in units of h bar. And so what you find is that these numbers are actually much, much smaller than h bar over 2 that you get for a squid. Another thing that you see is, for example, for xenon, we have actually measured the value of T2 in our lab at 500 tamagats. And so that gives you then a fundamental resolution on that order. For mercury, surprisingly, even though it's very good for precision measurements, no one had actually measured the intrinsic interaction that will cause relaxation. So usually it's limited by the walls. So potentially it could be also very, very good. Then if you go to the electron spins, so all of these are nuclear spins here. If you go to electron spins, then generally the energy resolution is a little bit worse, and the field sensitivity and frequency is also worse, but still it's smaller than h bar. And again, these are experimental values. So it's roughly true that if you have a nuclear spin, you can measure magnetic field better than if you have an electron spin. The only problem is that the bandwidth is very small, so you have to measure it for a long time before you get there.
Mike, mm-hmm. Question. Why do you think that if you don't do the second order sort of analysis for squid, you wouldn't get better sensitivity also?
What do you mean second order analysis?
Well, I mean, you've done a naive estimate for spins and you got h bar over 2. Now you went into a more sophisticated analysis and you get 10 to minus 7.
Well, I mean, it's still different because the squid is a single degree of freedom. And so then it, this idea of a linear amplifier, I think, applies to it. And so perhaps Conrad can say, something about it. But my understanding is that it's all different since you have, really fundamental limit on for an amplifier in that case. So, it's 1 degree of freedom versus here, there's many degrees of freedom. Then the other thing you can ask in general, there are many people working on electron spin magnetometers in a solid state system. And so I got this plot which sort of basically summarizes all of the measurements, and in particular, there's some interesting new results of rubidium and parahydrogen which are actually very promising. All of these are based on spin decoupling. So you have to apply some kind of a spin hacker to actually get these values of T2. If you just measure it sort of in the simplest way, it will be typically much shorter somewhere over here. So generally, it's true that if you have electron spins in the solid, the only way you can get something that's very long is to actively... I got rid of this.
No, the X of the top.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah. I see. So the only way you can get longitude is by actively basically prevent the dephasing of the spins by applying some, you know, some pulses, which typically limits your ability to detect DC magnetic fields, but you can detect AC fields in this way. So then we decided that that nuclear spins, in principle, are the best spins to make magnetic field measurements or measurements of any kind of small spin interactions. Then how can we detect the precession of nuclear spins? Turns out that the best way to do it is to use optical detection if you can. And sort of a simple way to think about it is that the precession frequency happens, let's say, at 10 hertz. Well, with optical detection, by relying on angle momentum selection rules, you can convert the 10 hertz photon into some kind of UV photon, which you can detect with efficiency of unity, almost unity. And so that's the reason why it's so much more efficient than any other method. And so with mercury, it works because this line is accessible, although with some trouble, at 254 nanometers. And so this is an example of super precession of mercury 199 in the EDM experiment, where you basically pump it here with a laser, and then you could look at the precession. So this is what the signal looks like over a time scale of 100 seconds or so. These are beautiful signals with, you know, efficiency, which is basically almost limited by the fluctuations of the number of atoms in the cell. Now, you can also try to do it with other species, like with xenon 129, where what you have to do is to use a two-photon transition, again, at about the same wavelengths. And this was tried at the University of Michigan by Tim Chapp and his student, and so they almost got to the point where you could see a signal and use it for measurement of spin precession. Now, the most common way that people detect nuclear spin precession is by magnetic detection. So you just look at the magnetic field created by the spins. The easiest way to do it is to do an NMR, and so some of the initial work by Tim Chapp with a spin maser was actually very good, and this is limit on the EDM of xenon that came from that. Then you can use a squid and, for example, look at the protection of helium and xenon. You can use external atomic magnetometer, as Dima had mentioned in his talk yesterday, or you can use an internal magnetometer where the alkali metal is interacting with the nuclear spin directly, which is what I mostly will be talking about. So if we talk about alkali metal magnetometers, why they're so useful, because they have these easily accessible optical transitions with a diode laser, so you can do the same thing as with mercury. And the vapor density is relatively high, so you have to heat your sample to only like 100 C to get a large number of atoms. And if we're going to work with nuclear spins, we need to use alkali metal anyway to polarize the nuclear spin, and so it's already present in the system. Now, with alkali metal, you will again have collisions, and now there is a different kind of collision, the spin exchange collision, that turns out to be significant. So the idea of spin exchange collision is that the overall spin of these two atoms is conserved, but they basically exchange spin. In principle, this should not somehow kill your sensitivity, but in many cases it does. And this cross-section is relatively large, so if you just plug in the numbers, you will get a sensitivity of about 1 femtotesla for 1 centimeter cube, which is not as good as you would expect based on the initial things I was talking about.
So can you explain why decrease the sensitivity since
it's
a big concern?
Yeah, so I'll explain it right here. So because in alkali metal, you have actually two spins. You have electron spin and the nuclear spin. So the collision happens very fast. So the electron spin exchange, the nuclear spin, don't realize that they got exchanged. And so the atom, which was in one hyperfine state, finds itself in the other hyperfine state because electrons swap and doesn't align with the nuclear spin anymore. Now, in a magnetic field, the energy splitting is opposite. So you can think of it as they process in opposite directions in a magnetic field. So when you have a swap of the spin, you basically randomize the direction. And so the basic trick then, if you go to very low field, you can again go into the regime of motional narrowing that I mentioned before, where the spin exchange collision happens much faster than the precession around the magnetic field. And so the expectation value of the spin become kind of locked and follow each other. So when you have spin exchange collisions, it doesn't matter anymore because the both point in the same direction. And then what this gives you is a line width which is dramatically narrow. So it goes from something like 3 kilohertz at the typical density to something like 1 hertz. And so this is not a new idea. It's actually something that well, Hapa had you know, experimentally measured a very long time ago. And so then what you like to do is to operate a very low magnetic field. And the easiest thing is to just go to zero field. And so typically we operate a magnetometer in zero field, where the pump laser is what sort of defines the quantization axis. And you just keep pumping the atoms. And if you have a small magnetic field, it causes rotation. They try to rotate, but they rotate very slowly. So in one lifetime, they don't rotate very far. They rotate by some angle alpha, which is proportional to T2, but it's less than 1. So what you measure is just the tilt of the spin. And then the tilt of the spin you can measure with a probe laser, which is typically linearly polarized, and then you rely on optical rotation, so the indices of refraction it will be different for sigma plus minus light, and that gives you a rotation of the polarization of the probe depending on where the spin is pointing. So that's sort of the easiest way to look at the signal. So this is sort of a picture of one of our magnetometers. Now, the thing that I want to point out here is that how empty the optical table is, actually. So there's just like a few pieces of optics, but compared to, you know, Skoll-Lartner experiment, this is actually very, very easy to do. So as far as magnetic field sensitivity, the highest sensitivity we have achieved so far is about 160 attotesla. And the basic idea here is to use a gradiometer. So it's very hard to find a region in space which, you know, is completely free from magnetic noise, especially if you don't use superconducting shields. So by building a gradiometer, you can take difference at 2 points, and that would reduce the noise by about one order of magnitude. So you go from sort of this line here, which is about 1 femtotesla, to this line here. And then we build this innermost shield out of a special ferrite material, which is electrically insulating, and so it basically makes less noise because, you know, absence of Johnson currents. And so then the energy resolution is the order of 7H, so it's not, you know, very close to the fundamental limit, but it's sort of in that regime of, you know, a few H. And now most recently there was a result at PTB, where they got 150 attotesla instead of 160. But I should point out that there actually is a bigger coil compared with our cell. And also the noise that they get at similar frequencies is actually higher than that. But the advantage of SQUID, on the other hand, is that it's more broadband. So they have a bandwidth of maybe a few kilohertz, whereas we have a bandwidth of only maybe 10 hertz or so. Now the next step is that if you want to couple the alkali metal to the noble gas, we have to think about spin exchange. And so that's the basic process by which you polarize the spins that Bill was talking about in the morning. So when you have a collision between electron in alkali metal and the noble gas nuclear spin, you can think of some Hamiltonian, which is just basically a scalar interaction. But this is only happens for a short time. So you have an evolution of the density matrix, and you could expand it to second order. So you end up with two effects. One is basically a coherent effect that you could think about as a magnetic field. And then the other is the actual spin flip, which is what produces the polarization of the nuclear spins. So this coherent effect, if, for example, you know, one spin has magnetization, M, you will see a magnetic field which is enhanced by the factor kappa naught compared with a classical dipolar field you would see. And this kappa naught turns out to be very big in most cases, so you basically for free get an amplification of the classical dipolar field. I should point out in general that this expression you know, it's just a way you know, of keeping track of the numbers, because you never actually get a situation where kappa naught is exactly one. So if you have alkali and nuclear spin, you have kappa naught which is much bigger than one. If you have two nuclear spins, then kappa naught is approximately zero because they cannot be on top of each other. So this, this is the kappa naught, the cycle to one is just like a very simplistic classical picture.
That the noble gas fields in, so you have a mixture of alkali and noble gas, xenon, helium, whatever. So this field is the magnetic field felt by the noble gas.
So it goes both ways.
Ah, okay.
So you know, if noble gas is polarized, then the alkali metal is going to fill the field. And the other way works exactly the same way with the same constant. So if the alkali metal is polarized, the noble gas is going to fill the field as well.
And that it fills it 500 times stronger than you would naively think. This is
That's right. So this kappa naught is the same. So it's enhanced in both directions.
In both directions. And the reason, where is this coming from?
Well, you can think about it as effectively a hyperfine interaction. So just like in an atom, you have a nucleus and electron spin, and they like to be on top of each other. So you know, here you have a collision, and for a short time, electron spin actually goes and interacts with the nucleus spin with a delta function interaction. And so that happens, you know, sufficiently frequently, then you get this enhancement. And so you know, basically, you can think of for xenon, because it's a bigger nucleus, it's more, you know, bigger charge is more attractive for the electron, so that's why it's bigger, you know, roughly speaking. So then, one way we can take advantage of all of these things is to build a co-magnetometer where we combine the electron spin and the nucleus spin in one cell, and then we arrange it so that they basically both measure magnetic field at the same time. And so we just have a spherical cell, the same as we've been using before, and we put helium-3 in it instead of, let's say, helium-4, the buffer gas. And so then helium-3, after a while, you know, is polarized by spin exchange collisions. And so then potassium will fill a magnetic field from helium-3 given by this expression. And now this field can be fairly large. It can be on the order of 5 milligauss, 10 milligauss, something like that. So since the alkali metal magnetometer likes to operate at zero field, you just apply an external field which cancels the field that is produced inside the cell. And so the potassium magnetometer is still at zero field because these two vectors are supposed to cancel each other. And so then, since it's at zero field, it operates in this regime of high sensitivity, and it can sense the orientation of the helium magnetization. So they basically are simultaneously working as magnetometers. And so the way you can kind of visualize it with a hand waving way is to imagine what happens is if in addition to this field that I applied, there is a small transverse field that somehow developed. So then the total external field will get tilted like this. And then if the tilt is slow, then the helium generally will adiabatically follow that tilt, and it will also get tilt. And so then, because these two vectors are parallel to each other, and they both got tilted to first order, they continue to cancel each other. So the system then is insensitive to an external magnetic field, because basically it's compensated automatically. But on the other hand, if you imagine a situation where you have a coupling to only one of the two spins and the other one doesn't move, then this compensation would not happen. So so at the end, your signal is given by the difference in the magnetic field that potassium is filling and helium is filling. So if this is a regular magnetic field, then these would be the same fields, and then you would get no signal. But if this is some kind of anomalous field that only couples to one of the spins, then you will get a signal. Another way you can see what's happening is to think what happens if the field is oscillating. So if it's oscillating sufficiently fast, then the helium will not follow it exactly adiabatically, and you would get an extra signal, which will become smaller and smaller as you go to lower and lower frequency. And so this is the suppression factor that you get, which is basically the degree to which this is canceled. Now, this suppression factor, in this case, includes also suppression of the magnetic shield, which is about 10 to the minus 6. And then the rest of it you get from this cancellation here.
What is the turnover again at about 10 hertz?
So this is the point which corresponds largely to the precession frequency of the spins, the helium spins. And so when you go above that, this basic picture doesn't work anymore because the helium spin doesn't respond to it at all. And the bandwidth of the alkaline metal magnetometer is also decreased. So there's two effects which make it turnover. So at the end, what happens when you operate the co-magnetometer, you operate below this resonance frequency. The typical operating regime is below 1 hertz or so. And of course, inevitably at low frequency, you have some 1 over F noise, which is what we spend most of our time fighting. This is a problem that limits us from looking at extremely low frequency. But if you operate in this regime here, you can get fairly good sensitivity, so something on the order of 1 femtotesla per square root of hertz, which means that if you integrate for, let's say, 1 month, you can get a frequency resolution of 20 picohertz for helium, 20 nanohertz for the electron spin. But to get this result, you need to modulate in this frequency range, which is, sometimes it's a little bit difficult. Now, the other thing you can do is you can actually place helium-3 with neon, which you have done more recently, and has a couple of advantages. First of all, the magnetic moment is smaller, so it is less sensitive to external magnetic field. Also, it has a spin 3/2. So if you look for effects of Lorentz violation, which is quadrupolar in nature, you cannot detect it was helium-3, but you can with neon-21. The other trick you have to use is this hybrid optical pumping, where we use cesium that's optically pumped by spin exchange polarized rubidium and then neon. The reason why we do that is so that the vapor of cesium is optically thin, so the laser can penetrate it and uniformly polarize it. Otherwise, rubidium turns out to be optically thick, so you cannot fully polarize it, and you don't want to increase the buffer gas pressure because neon has quadrupolar relaxation with the buffer gas. You want to actually operate at the pressure approximately 1 atmosphere. So.
One question. Why you don't choose the potassium, rubidium, and then niobium? I think potassium is more sensitive.
Potassium turns out doesn't have quite as high spin exchange cross section with neon, so we have measured that and we found that for. In the case of neon, rubidium works better than potassium. And you could potentially use potassium here. That doesn't really matter so much. So one of the sort of practical applications of this is to use it as a gyroscope. So a simple test is that if you take your optical table, which is floating, and you wiggle it a little bit by a few micrometers, and then you can monitor the position of the table and calculate the velocity from that, and then independently calibrate the sensitivity of the magnetometer, and you get a good overlap. And this is sort of the foolproof way of calibrating the system to make sure it's actually sensitive to some kind of anomalous interaction, because rotation is an example of anomalous interaction, which will not couple to nuclear electron spins the same way, so it would not cancel in the magnetometer. So that's usually how we calibrate the system to make sure it actually works. Now, the other thing you can do is you can change the orientation of it relative to basically In the Laban, you see a signal which is a projection of the Earth's rotation. So if you look at the performance of this, it's actually a fairly good gyroscope, at least for short time scale. For short time scale, it works as well as an atomic interferometer gyroscope. But as I was saying before, at longer time scale, there's 1 over F noise. So at approximately 1 hertz, so 1 second, we can get very good performance, but then there is significant drift at longer times. And so we're working right now on a way of introducing additional modulation schemes to basically suppress this 1 over F noise. But otherwise, it could be used you know, as a good gyroscope. So now, if you look at the at the signal expression I had written, you might be a little bit puzzled because the expression that I had written for the value of the signal does not depend on the property of the nuclear spin. So it does not depend on the degree of polarization of the nuclear spin. It does not depend on the coherence time of the nuclear spin. So that cannot be right, because I would say that what's important is very long coherence time. And so it turned out the way we operate the co-magnetometer actually is not the most sensitive way of doing it. There's a more sensitive way of operating the magnetometer. And to do that, you have to take the nuclear spin like helium and tip it perpendicular to some bias magnetic field and then make it precess. And so if it precesses around the bias field, so you get a signal like this. So what we usually get with the previous description is just like a DC signal. But now we're actually making it rotate, so we're measuring a sine wave. And then we want to find what is the frequency of the sine wave. And so you can calculate the frequency from this expression here. And so, you know, basically measure it for approximately the value of the coherence time, and you can show that the optimal sensitivity then in the measurement of the value of this field B naught is the sensitivity of the alkali metal magnetometer divided by this factor here. And this factor now depends on the coherence time of the nuclear spin and the amount of magnetization in the nuclear spin. So that's what you expect. If you have, you know, higher polarization of helium or longer coherence time, you should get better sensitivity. And so this factor is typically on the order of, you know, 100 to maybe 10 to the 4. So that's how you can win by using nuclear spin and looking at their precession. Now, the issue is that we have kind of two problems. One is that in order for this to work, we have to actually introduce a magnetic field, so it's no longer zero field. And second is that we want to measure a transverse field of where the main field is pointing this way. So typically, a magnetometer, you know, we will look at the absolute value of the field, and we want to measure just this component, which is usually smaller than the bias field. And so to overcome this problem, we introduced sort of a new scheme of operating it, which allows us to extend the surf regime to sort of moderate magnetic fields on the order of a few milligauss. And the basic idea is to apply a series of pi pulses, which decouple a spin from the precession in the bias field, but still allow it to precess in the field you're trying to measure, which is B1 in this case. And so if you look at this, what happens is that the spin is precessing in both fields, but after the pi pulse, the precession because of B0 will cancel, and the precession because of B1 will add. And the other thing which is important is that because the three spins are precessing in opposite directions, when we apply pi pulse, they end up together again. So what we can preserve, basically spin exchange free with the pi pulses. And the key factor is that the repetition rate of them has to be bigger than the precession in the field B naught. So as the rate of them increases, you get a bigger signal, and at the same time, the line width becomes small.
Stupid question. So if you just wanted to measure a three-dimensional field, you basically just apply this B naught along three different axes and then measure the transverse each time?
So what you imagine in this case is the field along the axis of the pulses. So the value of B naught field you can apply in any direction, it will become decoupled. But what you're sensitive to is this direction. So this is what defines the orientation that is called y in this case. And so in principle, this allows us to eliminate spin exchange relaxation. The only limitation is that when these pulses are applied, the spins actually are in a big magnetic field, so spin exchange turns on again. So the key is to make these pulses very short, and so the duty cycle of them is what's limiting us. So as the rate is increasing, you can see there's basically a bottom line here that goes up and up. And so if the pulses are shorter and stronger, then this line will be flatter and it would work better. So then we can operate a co-magnetometer with two nuclear spins. Now, one of the things we lose in this arrangement is that we cannot use the alkaline metal itself as a co-magnetometer. So it just basically is a sensor for the precession of the nuclear spins. And it's not good enough as a co-magnetometer because we're trying to get this extra amplification factor. So we have to use two nuclear spins to amplify them at the same time. And so we can use, for example, helium 329, which is spin 1/2 system. So, it's a clean system. And so typically then you would pump the atoms and apply pi over 2 pulse and then look at the precession signal for about 100 seconds and then apply some gradient to basically, initialize the system again. And if you look at the spectrum of the signal, it's actually fairly clean. So we have a SNR of something like 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6, which is very good, even better than you can do with a squid. Now, there is another sort of problem that comes in here, which is this it's the opposite field, the field that the alkali metal is creating on the nuclear spins. And so that's a field that we don't want to have, and we have to get rid of it somehow. And so the easiest way to get rid of it is to turn off the lasers. So if you turn off the lasers, you would think that the rubidium spins will not be polarized anymore. Now, it turns out it's not quite sufficient because they become a little bit polarized by spin exchange with noble gas, and that still gives us a little bit of a problem. So what we have to do is to actively depolarize them by applying a series of pi pulses in this interval here to basically make sure the polarization of rubidium is exactly zero. And then at the end, we turn on the lasers again and look at the final phase of the precession of the helium and xenon spins. So then this works fairly well because essentially we're running as a clock. And so if you look at the Allen variance, it goes down as t to the 1/2, as you would like. And after integrating for 8 hours, we can get a resolution of something like 7 nanohertz with no significant drift. But to get to that, we need to consider a number of facts which I don't have time to talk about. So you can look at the reference where, for example, the Sullivan, though it's spherical, it's not perfectly spherical, so there are some dipolar fields we have to worry about. And then these pulses that we're applying on the rubidium spins also affect the nuclear spins. And we have to you know, get rid of it somehow. But when we do all of these tricks, we can get sufficient sort of absolute accuracy that we can look at the factor of Earth rotation without having to rotate our apparatus. So in the past, we didn't really have any absolute scale. So to see the Earth's rotation, you have to reorient your apparatus and see it go up and down. But now, this is an absolute measurement, so you measure the frequency in an absolute way, and the ratio of the magnetic moments, you know, is measured you know, with sufficient precision that you could just basically plug it in, and you get this shift here, which is proportional to the rotation rate of the Earth. And so now let me talk a little bit about, you know, a slightly different trick, you know, of coupling electron and nuclear spins together. So far we could do it when the magnetic field is a few milligauss. But supposing you want to make the measurement on the nuclear spin when the magnetic field is a gauss, or maybe higher. And in principle, you can apply these pulses I was describing, but they would have to be extremely short and hard to do experimentally. So there is a different way of writing the magnetometer, which is basically applying a magnetic field that is parallel to B naught. So this is sort of is a problem that people have been thinking for a few years. The simplest thing you can do is to make a coil so that the field, let's say, of the nuclear spins inside there is different than the field of the alkali metal that you would have here. But it's hard to make a coil that has uniform field inside and outside. So this is not a very practical way of coupling two spins, which have, you know, very, very different frequencies of precession in a field of one gauss. And so the way that we do it is to introduce a strong field that's oscillating parallel to B naught, and the frequency of this field is basically is a sum of the difference of these two precession frequencies. So it's kind of a parametric magnetometer, and if the field is sufficiently strong, the same as B naught of that order, you can recover about 50% of the signal you would get if everything was operating on resonance. And so just as a quick demonstration of it, we have done some measurements with water, NMR signals. So, you know, it's basically a simple way, you know, of doing NMR. And this is done in a field of approximately one gauss. So the field that you apply is at approximately 1 megahertz. And so what you get at the end is this big is the peak of the RF field, and this signal here, the sideband, is an NMR signal, and you can make sure that it's actually decaying, you know, with T2 that you would expect if it's an NMR signal from protons and what. But the reason why this is sort of interesting is that you can also do something for detection of axions if you're looking in a frequency range somewhere over here from a few hundred hertz to maybe a few kilohertz, because you can operate these magnetometers with very high sensitivity as an RF magnetometer at a particular frequency. And then if the helium is actually placed inside the cell, then you'll get two enhancement factors. One is because of coupled knot, and the other because of geometric coupling. Since if you put it outside, it's always going to be smaller than what you get by putting it inside. So this is sort of a way of extending it to potentially look for you know, axion wind signals. Okay, so that's sort of my kind of general overview of, you know, different ways you can use alkali metal magnetometers. Now, let's see, how much time do I have?
About 10 minutes.
Okay, so I'll I'll say a few words about some of the things we're actually doing on this front. So one of the kind of experiments we've been looking at is the relation of local Lorentz invariants. And this field has rich history, over basically 100 years, starting from the basic question whether the light is actually isotropic in all directions, if the speed of light is isotropic in all directions. And then you can ask the question if the energy levels of a nucleus are isotropic in all directions. And now it turned out that these two questions are actually closely related, so you can reformulate the interactions in the nucleus. So if there is a fact of this type that's coupling to light, it will show in the nuclear spins as well. And so our measurements, which are sort of the most sensitive of this kind, actually limit not only the interactions with the nuclear spins, but also the interactions with light, because they would show up with a coefficient of approximately 1. And this is described in this paper here. It recently came out. So then, how do we actually do the experiment? The most recent experiment of this type we have done at the South Pole. The reason for that is because of rotation of the Earth, which gives us a background signal because it's a gyroscope. And so sort of naively speaking, if you are sitting on the axis of the Earth and you rotate your apparatus around, it's the most isotropic place you can be. You have things like magnetic fields that you can cancel, but the Earth's rotation is not something you can cancel. So by rotating around a particular axis, you basically make everything around you look isotropic. And so the experiment is sufficiently simple that you can operate it without too much, interference. So everything sits in vacuum, and then we have just simple optical system. It's not tuned very often. And this is what happens when you actually do rotation of the experiment. So as you would expect, when you're at the pole, you will not see any signal, whereas if you're in Princeton, you'll see a big signal because you're sitting at an angle. And so, as I mentioned before, we get the best sensitivity if we modulate the signal at a time scale of about 10 seconds. So this whole apparatus is designed to rotate around the vertical axis every few seconds. And so we're basically making a measurement by looking this way, and then looking this way, and looking this way, and looking that way. And so this is a summary of the data that have taken over 2 years. And generally, it's fairly good. Of course, it was not perfect, so some data were noisy initially, then we fixed some problems, it worked much better. The improvement is indicated here compared with the previous experiment we have done at Princeton. So then the other in kinds of experiments you can do is to look for spin-dependent forces. And so this is the idea of Wilczek that people have been exploring all this time. So you have different type of interactions like monopole-monopole, monopole-dipole, so spin-mass interaction, or a dipole-dipole spin-spin interaction. And all of these have limits of various kinds. And so we've been playing with some of these experimental arrangements to improve some of the limits. Now, a few years ago now, we have done one experiment that basically pushed everything the best we could by starting with a nuclear spin source. So it's basically a collection of helium-3 atoms which are polarized in the cell. And the nice thing about the helium atoms, you can flip them with RF, AFP passage, without disturbing any in the apparatus. And so we could flip it every few seconds, and then make measurements for approximately 1 month, and we get this uncertainty, kind of what we would expect, on the order of approximately it's in gigahertz, which I believe is still the smallest energy shift that was measured in any kind of experiment. And the field sensitivity is a fraction of an auto Tesla. Now, more recently, we've been working on experiments where we're looking for couples between spin and mass. And so that's not quite as simple. You cannot, flip the scene with a field. You have to move it with a big motor. And so that obviously creates more disturbance in the experiment. So these masses are suspended from the ceiling, and we're moving them back and forth, every few seconds. And the magnetometer is sitting right here, in the middle between them. And so this experiment has been going on for about a year now, collecting data, and we're almost there. So we do have some background effects that are associated with the motion of the masses. And so we have to subtract them from the signal, but we have at least two ways of estimating how to do the subtraction. And so the basic idea is that over this time scale, you're moving the weights, and here you're collecting the data, and you can see there is some wiggle here if you don't do the subtraction, but if you do subtraction, then this becomes flat. And so with two different ways, within the subtraction, we think we understand what's going on, but we like to collect a little bit more data just to make sure that everything behaving the way that we understand. And so eventually we expect the uncertainty on the order of approximately 0.1 femtotesla, which would be a factor of 10 improvement over existing limits in this area. And then the other experiment that we are doing is sort of similar to some of the work that is now at the University of Washington, where we're using a magnet, which is special in that it has a big contribution of spin angular momentum. So when you put it inside the shield, the orientation of the spin is not canceled, and you end up with a net spin. And so you can take the spin, which is electron spin in this case, and just rotate it back and forth. And so this thing is sitting over here in the magnetic shield, and we flip it every few seconds again. And in this case, it's a little bit cleaner because it's a smaller mass. So we can take similar data, and again, the final uncertainty will be approximately the same, but it's an improvement by actually probably a few orders of magnitude And if you look at the data here, it's cleaner, and we don't have to do too much of corrections or subtractions.
This is
distance, also sort of like 20 centimeters or so. Okay, so I think that is all that I wanted to say. So in general, I guess the idea is that with nuclear spins, you can make very sensitive measurements of magnetic fields, but also interactions which are somehow new and unexpected. And there are a few different ways of detecting them. Probably the best way of doing it is with optical detection or with in situ alkali metal detection. And so that's basically the area where we're pushing to achieve the best possible sensitivity, although the fundamental limits that are indicated at the beginning are still very far away. So we could still do much better than what we've done so far. And in particular, in the case of Lorentz violation, this sets the best limits in the spin and in the photon sector from these types of experiments. Thank you.
convective counter.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the hybrid convective counter has a higher correlation, and that, which means it has higher self-constitution than a theory, right?
That's the idea, yeah, that's right.
I think that there will be a requirement for the stability for the magnetic field you apply in the Z direction, because you need to apply a larger magnetic field in the
pumping direction. Yeah, well, you know, it's never very large. It's still in the order of a few milligauss. But the bigger the field is, the faster is the response time. So the overall bandwidth of the system becomes bigger, and so it's, you know, easier to operate.
Okay. So also, I think the hybrid pumping has the light shift problem, because you pump one outlier species and another species has some detuning.
Yeah, that's a good question. So you'd like to pick them so that it's far away. For example, we had some problems when we used rubidium and potassium because they're relatively close than one light shift. So that's one of the reasons for using cesium, because it's much farther away than the light shift is very small. Well, no, it won't reduce because the cesium is just a small fraction, so it doesn't really affect the overall relaxation time since it's only... Is at 1% or so.
So my final question is, hybrid pumping co-magnetometer combined with the potassium helium 3 co-magnetometer, which is better, you think?
So if you look at rotation sensitivity, if used as a gyroscope, then it definitely works better with neon. When you look for sort of spin-dependent forces, it depends on your coupling, right? So, you know, with neon, only some fraction of the spin is actually, you know, coming from the neutron, so you lose a little bit there and so on. So it's approximately comparable in that case.
When you leave the previous terms, do you by any chance use the Dobresko Moshe parametrization?
I think I've heard that name, but I haven't used it. if you're talking about these things, then no, we just look at. You know, at basically these very basic terms here.
What is it? Well, so Wilczek and Moody, they have introduced this, and then Dobresko and Moshe.
I think I know what you're talking about. So this thing was like 16 terms.
16 terms.
That's right. For example, in this experiment here, we had done a little bit of that, and we tried to constrain as many terms as possible. Probably for these experiments, we're not going to do all possible, combinations.
Just a warning that there are some issues with some of those terms. This will be cleared up in the paper very soon.
Okay.
So the experiment with the co-magnetometer, where you run in the dark and allow the evolution to happen, and then, so is there any issue with like settling time or some sort of when you switch the laser on?
Yeah, we do see a little bit of an effect. So if you look here, so you find that when you turn on the laser here, it changes slightly the temperature of the cell. And so the signal does not just simply decay, but it kind of grows a bit and then decays. But it only affects amplitude, it doesn't affect the frequency as far as we can tell. So we just introduce like an extra parameterization there, and then it fixes that problem. But that's a good question.
Maybe not so much for a question, just kind of addressing the point earlier about the magnetic sensitivity of squids and so on. I'm perfectly happy to believe that there are much better magnetometers for particular applications than squids, for sure. Just the point being that two quantities can have the same dimensions, they can have the same units, but they may enter into your mathematical idealization of the experiment in very different ways. Magnetic field might be something which is imposed, in which case it really can't fluctuate in any way. And then there's really no sort of sense, there's no quantum fluctuation of such a quantity, it's not a dynamical variable. Or it might be a dynamical variable, in which case it has zero-point motion. And I guess the distinction, I think, might at least be partly that.
Yeah, no, I think it's true. There's not really an uncertainty relationship that says you cannot measure magnetic field to some particular value. So you can measure it as well as you can. I guess it's a question of whether there was a squid, since there's only one degree of freedom, it sort of couples in a way that you cannot overcome this limit of a linear amplifier. and maybe understand yourself.
There's no, in principle, limit on magnetic field sensing, but a squid tends to be limited to this number that you stated.
So
you must have thought about it. So supposing you found the local Lorentz invariance at one decimal digit beyond 10 to the minus 35, say 10 to the minus 36, where would you go next? Supposing you found it.
Well,
someone else can find.
I guess the first question is to make sure it's real. Yeah, all right. I mean, there is, you know, in terms of comparing to other experiments, there are some experiments looking at cosmic rays for, you know, very high energy particles, which constrain sort of quantities which are vaguely similar to what we can constrain, but it's not exactly the same. So, you know, if you want to confirm this, you probably want to do, you know, some other experiment with spins. But there are sort of other, you know, other things looking at what is the maximum possible energy, you know, of, you know, so, you know, electron, and that's, you know, somehow related a little bit to some of these.
Sorry, how would it manifest in cosmic spectrum?
Well, so you have maximum limiting velocity. And so you cannot have particles higher than a particular velocity. That's right. And then you can have Cherenkov radiation if they're higher. And so there's a whole range of possibilities.
Some of these could be, just as a theoretical parenthesis, some of these terms could be attributed to dark matter. So from a theorist perspective, because the dark matter, as we move through the action wind, for example, it appears as a vector, right? It's a Lorentz violating effect. So if the first question as a theorist as I would ask is, can it be fit with something less, more conventional as dark matter?
I'm asking for that kind of a connection.
I'd like to make a comment. If you saw something with spins, you don't want to do something like look at the cosmic rays or anything like that. You want to first make sure it's really in there and spin it. Because if you look at something else, some theorists can always go blah, 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 and never learn anything, okay? You got to just make sure that the effect that was observed by one experiment can be reproduced. That's a very important point.
Right, yeah.
There's a sort of a parallel range of activities where you look at the influence of all of the same factors like lab on, not on the spin, but on the clock transition.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another possible substitute.
All right, if there's no more questions, we'll take a 10-minute break.